Acknowledgement of Country. I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, work and study, the Awabakal and Worimi people. I would like to extend that to the land on which our listeners meet on. I pay my most heartfelt respect to elders past, present and emerging. Listener discretion is advised. The topics we discuss in this podcast may be disturbing to some. If you feel confronted by anything discussed in today's episode, please contact Lifeline or the University's free counselling service. This episode is dedicated to Daniel Morecambe and all victims of child abuse. May their voices be heard. And if you can't get enough criminology content, then you should check out the CCJS blog run by Molly Lancet. Welcome back to the Your Wen Crim podcast. I'm your host, Isabella Krebet, and today we're investigating body farms. And I'm joined by Tori Berezowski and Dr. Xanthi Mallett. Ladies, how are you?
Yeah, very good, thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, doing well. We made it through the week, so that's a win.
It's always a positive. Body farms. How did you become interested in this area?
Oh, well, body farms, as they are colloquially all known, we generally don't refer to them as that when we work at them, but it's not so much being interested for me in working at a body farm per se, it's about the research that you undertake at these facilities. So they're basically just sites where you can undertake interesting forensic research. So yeah, they're a means to an end, but they're certainly unique places.
How did you become involved in this area?
Tori, do you want to do that one?
Yeah, sure. Well, when I started doing my undergraduate degree, I got interested in forensic science, and like Xanthi said, it's a mean to an end. So the only way to accomplish the research goals that I had was to work at a body farm. As a forensic anthropologist, we often work with skeletal collections as well, but a lot of the time those skeletal collections can come from individuals that were, newer collections will come from individuals that were in the research facility first and then skeletonized and used for future research.
What was it like the first time that you saw a body in an academic or professional setting?
Jaws, like the crappy fake bodies
they kind of look a bit like that. And I walked in and my first instinct was like, is this a joke? And obviously I knew it wasn't, but they just didn't look like people do in life. And I was really kind of surprised by that. And yeah, and then we just kind of got on with the job. And you kind of forget what you're doing once you kind of get into it. And so we did the postmortems, and yeah, and then I kind of got over that. That was my first instinct, was like, they don't look like they do in life. People change really quickly. So yeah, that was my first. And I still remember walking into that room and going, huh, this is weird.
Mine was also in my undergrad. We I took a, I think it was a forensic pathology course or something, and our big outing was to go to the hospital, and it wasn't a forensic autopsy or postmortem. It was just a regular one. So it was an older gentleman who's probably in his 80s or 90s. So you could tell that he looked old, but he absolutely looked fake. And the thing that got me was the colorless eyes. So when you look at people, one of the first things you notice is their eyes. You have this bright, vibrant color. With dead people, that's one of the first things that goes, is they just lose that color. And I remember them, they told us to specifically, like, they opened the eye and told us to look in, and I was like, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And it just kind of, like, obviously I knew he was dead and there was nothing there, but it just, in that moment, it hit me. I was like, this is a dead person, and I am looking at it. But I remember the pathologist was like, all right, look out for your friends, people might faint. So the whole time I'm looking around, I'm like, is anyone really going to faint? No one did, but I was like watching to make sure people didn't faint. And then I was like, wait, am I going to faint? I hope not. And I didn't. So
I have seen it. I have seen people faint when I used to teach Dundee in anatomy. Med students come in, and the first time they come in and see a room full of cadavers that they're going to be dissecting for an entire semester for a med degree or dental degree, I have seen students faint to that point, because you never know how you're going to respond until you're in that situation, regardless of how well psychologically prepped you are. Until you actually are there in the moment, you don't know. So I've seen students faint, and I've seen police officers get pretty pretty rocked as well. Again, it's such an odd position to find yourself in, you know, that anyone, regardless of what your background is or whatever, can be a bit overwhelmed with what's happening.
When do you think is the most appropriate time for someone in that setting to see a body?
Well, probably as early on as possible, just because you don't know how they're going to react or how you're going to react. And if you think it's something you want to do and realize that you can't handle it, then it's good to know early, as opposed, 6 years into your studies, you see a body and you're like, oh, actually, no, I don't like this.
Yeah, I'd agree. As early as possible, and it contains the situation. So when you go into a forensic suite, med school or dental school or whatever, then everything is controlled. And I think that's a good environment for that to happen. It's not great when police become officers, for example, and the first deceased person they see is from an RTA. That's not great. So I think as early as possible in a controlled environment is probably the best way to go.
Talk us through the process of decomposition.
Sure. So I just did a bit of research on this, actually, to refresh my memory. It goes through a couple different stages. You start with, fresh decomp. So you get RTV that was talk about rigor and liber mortis. So rigor mortis is when your body gets really, really tight, the muscles clench. And liber mortis is when all the blood pools. So they have often on TV, they're like, oh, I know how they died because the blood pooled this specific way, which is true. That is a good way to tell how someone died.
Oh, the body's been moved. Yeah.
Exactly. And then it goes through something called autolysis, which is destruction of the cells. So once your heart stops pumping blood and your brain stops working, your cells just start to self-destruct, essentially, by their own enzymes. And then you get into early decomp stages, which is skin color changes, sometimes called marbling. You can start to bloat. So sometimes if you see really fresh bodies, their stomachs are really, really bloated. Looks like it's honestly going to, pop like a balloon. It usually doesn't, but it can. You get skin slippage, which is probably my least favorite part of decomp, is seeing the skin literally just, fall off. And then with that, you get like hair loss and you can get blisters. And then your mouth, nose, and your anus starts to purge. So it just kind of opens up and stuff comes out because your body's just releasing everything because it's dead. And then you get into advanced decomp, which is goes into putrefaction and liquefaction. So it's just the process of rotting and decaying organic matter. Everything turns to liquid. And then sometimes you get mummification. Often in Australia, you get mummified bodies. And then the ultimate step, or the end step, would be skeletonization. So nothing's left except for the skeletal remains.
Wow, sounds really nice.
And you definitely don't smell that. I can guarantee you that.
You know what, though? I can take a decomposing body smell over the smell of garbage. So...
that's very interesting.
That's an acquired scent, though, Tori. I think that's not quite normal, to be honest. I know what you mean, totally, but yeah.
So, Xanthi, you mentioned earlier that Body Farm is the colloquial term, and a taphonomy facility is the correct term. What is forensic taphonomy?
Well, taphonomy is basically the study of decomposition. You know, all the stages of decay that any organic, well, normally when we talk about forensic facilities, humans go through. We do use some animal models to help with that, but basically it's the study of decomposition from point of death right the way through to skeletonization, and even actually past skeletonization, because the bones will still leach material and will still have uptake even after they've become, no tissue is left. So it's the entire process of post-mortem degradation, in essence.
And what is a taphonomy facility?
It's a site, normally outdoors, where people bequeath their remains post-mortem. So once they die, they've actively left their body to science, and they are placed at these facilities to decompose, to undertake different amounts or different types of research. And that could be forensic anthropology, like Tori and I do, but it could be a whole range of other things. People look at scent markers for decomposition. They look at heat markers using drones to determine, you know, how long the body will give off heat during the decompositional process. So how likely are we to find human remains, you know, through different types of foliage, you know, giving off heat markers. So there's a whole heap of research that can be done. And these sites are just a place where that can be done in a controlled way, which is also fully secure as well, because obviously we have a duty to protect the individuals that bequeath their remains to us. So we have to make sure that there's no interference from outside parties and they're fully protected within that site. They're normally pretty well secured, and we don't tend to advertise where they are. We don't want people just rocking up and, you know, wanting to have a look.
Can you tell us about the history of taphonomy facilities? Where was the first one established and why?
Well, the first one was in Tennessee, in Knoxville, Tennessee, back in, was it the 80s, Tori? It was quite a long time ago.
It was established in the 80s.
Yeah, 87, yeah. I think. Yeah. And that was just by an anthropologist who wanted to get more data, basically. So that was the first one. And then they had loads of remains out there. I've been to that one. And then since then, I think there are about 11 in the US now. They kind of add to them all the time. We're the only one in Australia. And then there's a new one in Quebec, in Canada. And I think there's going to be one in Europe soon, if that hasn't opened yet. Or is that actually open, that one, Tori? So there's a few now, looking at different sites across the world.
I thought the one in Amsterdam was open.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then the one in Canada is just recently open.
Yeah.
I want to say in 2020 it just opened.
Yep.
Is that run by an Australian woman?
Yes, Shari Forbes. Yes.
Shari Forbes, yeah.
Tori, I love that you were like, I think it's 87. When you've got the notes to say that it was 1987.
I think it was the 80s, and I think the purpose was anthropological to start with, and it's certainly grown since its earliest beginnings into, you know, training is undertaken there by different police, and you have, you know, cadaver dogs being trained on the human scent markers, because as Tori delightfully mentioned earlier, human cadavers smell different to everything else. So So a decomposing human smells different to a decomposing animal. Now, I don't think we've quite figured out chemically why that is, but obviously dogs have a much, you know, thousands times better scent or inclination than us. And so they need to scent mark on human material. So that's one of the training facilities can be used for. So it's certainly grown in and expanded in their use, and there's loads now. Although we do need more, we always need more. But yes, so there's it's great to have access to the only one in Australia.
Why did Australia need... Oh, sorry, Tori, you go. That was the pinnacle of your life.
Yeah.
So why did Australia need to establish a facility?
So decomp is, as we will discuss a bit later, it is affected by everything, but it's highly affected by the environmental conditions. So if it's really cold versus really hot, a body will decompose differently. How they're buried, if they're buried in the ground or on the surface, that will be important. If they're buried, the pH of the soil, the composition of the soil, all these different things will affect decomp, and we need to have them. We actually should probably have more than one in Australia, just to accommodate all the different environmental and soil changes, because the way the body decomposes here will be different to the way a body decomposes in WA or Tassie or something.
And what are your roles at the facility?
So I'm part of the management group. So part of my role is reviewing different projects that are put forward by partners and associates to see whether they are appropriate to be undertaken at the facility, and also undertake research there. So predominantly undertaking research is our role, our own projects. We share cadavers with other researchers, but yeah, most people there are undertaking discrete research projects.
And that's the same for you, yeah. Tori?
Yeah, I'm considered an external researcher.
In what ways can decomposition be tested?
Wow, what can it be tested? Loads of things. Obviously, we look at soft tissue loss and soft tissue changes. So those are predominantly things that a forensic anthropologist look at, but then other sides that could be entomology is another really important factor, looking at the stages and time since death, which is really what an anthropologist is trying to determine. When did somebody die? Because when you're trying to identify that person, that's one of the key factors of the key piece of information the police need. So yeah, entomology is probably the other really key one, especially in a recent death, I would say. Bugs. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. For anyone who doesn't know what an entomologist do, they look at bugs, largely flies, you know, but there are lots of different bugs that they would look at.
What are you looking for when you are conducting those tests?
I mean, it depends on the research question. Like for me, my personal research with SANS, university research with SANS, we're looking at detectability with geophysical techniques. But other people may be looking at how fast someone can decompose in a certain condition, or the how many bugs come and what bugs and what order, and what happens when you put a body in a car, what happens when you put a body buried in concrete. Like any research question that you want to test, we often try to mimic them out at the real life situations, and then you can just put the body in that sort of scenario and see what happens.
What differences?
One of the other research that I've done there.
Sorry, Zant, you start again.
I need to cut you off. Some of the other research we've done is looking at the full process of decomposition using time lapse photography. That's the first time that's been done in Australia. And actually, the body moves quite a lot after death as the tissues expand and contract. So, you know, looking at all of those elements as well. So there's lots of different things that can be done.
And what differences have been identified between Australia and American decomp?
I feel like there's no one answer to that. Like, and because in every different place, it'll be different. Something I've noticed here is bodies often mummify in Australia. And I think that's because of the, what was it? I read it earlier today. It was high heat and low humidity. And high heat, low moisture. But that's not a set in stone rule either. So,
no. And part of the problem is we've had really wet seasons after, and the bodies are still mummified. So we're still really confused as to why. I mean, we've only got one facility here, but what we were all a bit surprised at the bodies mummifying. Whereas the environment doesn't seem to dictate that that would be the natural outcome. So I think we need more facilities in similar environments to the current one, as well as different environments in Australia, to see whether that's replicated, because we currently don't know why. As Tori said, there's no one answer. I mean, there are so many different variables that affect the rates and stages of decomposition: altitude, ambient temperature, rainfall, all sorts of things. That question is so broad that, and individual ones too. Each individual will decompose differently depending on their body mass index, if they were taking any illicit or other drugs. You know, that will affect decomposition because it affects the entomological activity. So yeah, you could write a whole library on answering that question.
I read a study recently that said, as a general rule, 1 week on the surface is 2 weeks in the water and 3 weeks in a burial to reach the same level of decomposition, but that's a very general rule and was probably only generated in one place. I think I read it and it was in Texas. So that probably would not be the same here or in Canada or anywhere else in America. And I mean, one of the main questions with these taphonomy facilities was to standardize what we call the postmortem interval, so how long someone has been dead based on their decomposition level. And the more research we've done, the more questions we have. We're no closer to a standardized postmortem interval because I don't think there is one. It's just too variable of a topic.
So you mentioned a few things there about what can affect decomp. Can you go into a little bit more detail about those?
Everything. Everything can affect decomposition. So the altitude, the time of year, the ambient temperature, the rainfall, and all of the individual factors. Probably age will affect decomposition. I don't even know. Soil, pH, and everything. Everything. Everything about the environment that varies, which is ultimately variable, and anything about the individual that can vary, whether they're clothed, whether they are wrapped in anything, what kind of level of entomological activity you have, because what access do they have? Are they in something that is, you know, are they in a metal box that has no aerobic activity, for example? You know, everything affects decomposition.
I had a colleague tell me she ran a project. They buried two individuals. They were buried for a year, dug them up, and they were both in different stages of decomp. Similar the type individuals. And like, if you think about body mass index and like if they were wrapped or unwrapped, like that stuff would contribute. And they were in different stages of decomp. So, who knows?
Wow, that's really interesting. And can decay occur at different rates throughout the body?
Yeah, definitely. So often areas with more tissue can take longer to decompose because there's more tissue to disintegrate, essentially. But that being said, like stomach areas and your abdomen area often goes really quickly because that's where all the all these acids and stuff that they pool, and then it just disintegrates the skin. So it's like smaller, like hands and feet might skeletonize much quicker than, let's say, your femur or your legs, because there's less tissue. But then your stomach would decompose pretty quickly because of all the acids and stuff inside.
bugs more quickly, so your eyes, your nose, your mouth, your ears. Any injury sites will attract bugs as well, so that will encourage decomposition in those areas. So yeah, definitely get varying range. And we look at that, though, when we were, if we're estimating time since death, we rate different areas of the body and then come up with an overall estimate for time since death, looking at what's going on in different zones of the body.
And what impact does the differential decay have on an investigation?
It can affect the estimation of time since death. And so if you have an unknown individual, or even a known individual, estimating when they died can tell you a lot about the circumstances of death. So who was in the vicinity at the time, who was the last person to have seen them, who had access to that site. So time since death is really important to estimate as accurately as possible. But can be very challenging, especially in the earlier stages. It can be more accurate, but that depends on whether the heating's been on or it's been particularly cold in an environment. So there are always factors and variables to consider within that when you're estimating. But yeah, earlier on it's easier. When it gets into the latter stages, that's when it gets more and more guesswork, in essence, like best guess scenario. But yeah, crucial to an investigation, which is why so much work is undertaken in this area.
Tori, do you want to add anything?
You were saying in the early stages it's easier to assess TMI. The research that I've read can sometimes narrow it down to a day or two, looking at saying, oh, they died within 1 or 2 days. But then once you get to the latter stages of decomposition, it could be anywhere from like 1 to 60 days. So the PMI can get longer and less accurate the later you find the body in a stage of decomposition. And then when they're skeletonized, it's the most difficult to assess because there's no soft tissue at all to indicate it, like to have any indicators as to how long they've been dead.
And for post-mortem interval, you may be then looking at things like, well, you may need a palynologist in or somebody who understands about plant growth, because if you have skeletonized remains and you have certain plants that have grown in and around them, that could tell you, give you information as to how long those remains have been in situ or in that particular position. So it's about bringing different specialties together at that point to help augment the information that you have and improve that estimate based on not just the human remains, but the scene and environment as well.
And what role does the facility play in the criminal investigation process?
It doesn't play any direct role in the criminal investigation process. It's really about data collection, which informs the process later on. So improving our techniques of estimating time since death or post-mortem interval, as Tori referred to earlier, and how far you might expect chemicals to leak from human remains, or even if there's no body present, you know, can you tell from soil samples that a body has decomposed there? All of these things. So it doesn't play a direct role, but we can certainly test scenarios that are common within the criminal justice system and improve our understanding of those to improve outcomes.
And does the facility... Oh, sorry, Tori, you go. Sorry. And does the facility assist in training in specific areas of law enforcement and criminal investigation?
research facilities and actually use them for training purposes. So earlier this year, I was a part of a disaster victim identification training course with Victoria Police. And when they had said that they try to do that once a year or once every 2 years. So often police forces can train their members, especially their like crime scene members, on how to, you know, find maybe covert burials or how to dig up covert burials properly.
And these are really specialized skills, and it's important because in that particular scenario, they had multiple individuals in graves, and that's important because in a disaster victim identification scenario, you're really looking at multiple individuals, multiple deceased persons that need fully recovering forensic data to maximize the potential for evidence as well as identification. So they're really important skills, but unusual events, so they don't often get to actually put these into practice, fortunately. However, they do need to stay skilled up so that when that does happen, and this can happen on a massive scale, I think the ultimate would be 9/11, you know, the Twin Towers, all of the remains that need to recovering from those sites. That is a mass fatality event that required, you know, months and months worth of work and recovery to collect as much evidence and human remains as possible. So it's about keeping skilled up in those kind of scenarios using these facilities to do that.
I'm sure that this episode has sparked a lot of interest amongst our listeners. How can people get involved in this area?
Well, I personally did an archaeological degree and then moved into forensics. So my training in recovery and sites, etc., came from archaeology, which was common back then. There were less programs specifically for forensic anthropology. There are more now, but I would say that forensic archaeology is still the bedrock of that kind of scene examination before you get to the human identification part. Tori, I think you probably agree, it's science-based. A lot of students will contact me and say, I'd love to do forensic anthropology, and I say, what's your science background? And they say, oh, I don't have any. And they say, well, because it's not CSI, you don't push buttons and get an answer, you've got to have a strong science background. Is that what you would say, Tori?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had students ask me the same questions, and you definitely need a strong science background. I mean, for me, even specializing in anthropology, like forensic anthropology, I still had to take all of those science courses because a lot of the processes we need to understand are based in those hard sciences. So it's definitely a necessity if you want to take the forensic route.
Yeah, and if a student really wants to become a forensic scientist, I would say go to a university where they've got a really strong science foundational degree. And it doesn't necessarily matter whether it has the word forensic in it, because you can pick up those skills. Forensic just means pertaining to the court, so you can pick that up later anyway. But what you need to understand is the forensic principles on which the knowledge you will use in that forensic capacity, the scientific principles that you'll use in a forensic capacity later on. So get a really good grounding in science and add the forensic skills later. But yeah, that's the founding. A really good forensic scientist, you need good science skills.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me today, ladies. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We had a good
time. It was great to talk to you. Yeah, one of our favourite topics, hey?
You've been listening to the YOLWEN CRIM podcast, run by the University of Newcastle's Criminology and Criminal Justice Society, hosted by Isabella Krebet. A special thank you to this week's guests, Tori Berezowski and Dr. Xanthi Mallet. To Corey DiPasquale for composing the podcast theme music, and to Tamika Hillebrand for her ongoing support. I'm your host, Isabella Krebet, and I'll be back with another episode on September 6.